Kia ora and welcome to Meet the Newbies. After the 2017 general election happened, a lot of new MPs entered Parliament for the first time. However, many of these MPs may not be well known outside of their electorate. So to try and change this, I decided to do a podcast meeting with one of the new MPs each time. This gives us the chance to get to know our new lawmakers while giving them the chance to show who they are to the public. Today, we are talking to Chloe Swarbrick, the baby of the House and the youngest MP in 42 years. Let's find out about her.
How are you going today, Chloe?
I'm doing good, Dan.
Questions. How would you describe yourself in a sentence?
I guess I would say that I am determined to try and contribute to making a difference and getting other people involved as well.
What's your background?
It's pretty diverse, and probably as diverse as you can get for being 23 years old. Starting back from, I guess, high school, because that's where you're at. So I wasn't actually a big fan of high school, which is probably not a smart thing for a politician to say, so I got out of high school. But I didn't enjoy what's called the pedagogy, which is just basically the way of teaching, where basically you're given this information, you have to regurgitate it, and then you get, you know, your gold star, your sign of intelligence. I didn't think that that was how smarts and intelligence worked. I thought that you could be good at communicating or creative, and that could be a sign of intelligence. So basically, when I was in year 12 in sixth form, I approached my career guidance counsellor lady person and asked her how I could go to university early, because I didn't want to do year 13. And she told me that I couldn't, and I had to do year 13. But because I'm a millennial, I went home and Googled it, and I found out that there was this thing called discretionary, which was the University of Auckland. So I printed off those forms and went about convincing them it was a thing. So basically, when I was 17, I moved out of home and started at university. I started studying a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy, moved into also studying a law degree. While I was there, I also started working a number of different jobs, but also met my partner Alex, and we together started a number of businesses, first in fashion, then through publishing, then through consulting, and then eventually, about 2 years ago, we opened a little arcade and cafe. And in the meantime as well, I worked as a host for a daily kind of fair show called The Wire as a journalist.
So when did you realise you wanted to get into politics from there?
It was never really, it's funny, like a lot of people assume that it's this big life goal, but it never was. I was really grumpy when at the end of 2015, start of 2016, I was interviewing who the mainstream media had kind of pegged as the top four Auckland mayoralty candidates, so Phil Goff, Vic Curran, John Polino and Mark Thomas. And having grown up in Auckland basically my whole life, I was really unhappy with the lack of vision that they had for the city. So at that time I was 22, as everybody in the country came to find out. And, you know, I've witnessed a lot of my friends graduating from uni or working these jobs. They simply couldn't survive in Auckland, and creativity was leaving the main centre because it was coming far too expensive to hire spaces as art galleries and things like that. So I basically was complaining to my producer, Lillian Hanley, about it, and she goes, Chloe, if you're going to complain about it, you have to do something about it. So I went home and Googled it again, and I found out that literally the only barriers for somebody like me to stand for office was that I had to be over the age of 18, pay $200 for administrative costs, and have two people nominate me. I'm assuming it's kind of a bit stupid they're not calling for you. So I was talking to my friend Tom Dyson, who's actually my best friend, and he had just graduated from film school, so he knew how to make films. He got on board to make documentaries because he was like, you know, we know that the mainstream media is going to ignore you, so we'll make our own damn media, and we'll put it on Facebook and see how that goes. Yeah, it was basically as easy as that. Didn't know what the hell was going to happen, but just thought that I would try and show people that they didn't have to accept things the way that they are. Ran a campaign on that premise and produced policy, which I would argue was definitely the best policy campaign. It was definitely the most detailed, if anything. And ended up getting just shy of 30,000 votes when the final votes came in. So that after that, it was quite bizarre. I had a lot of people who'd obviously supported me asking me what I was going to do next. So I was always like, just going to go back to doing my businesses. But they wanted me to keep doing stuff. And that's kind of what I've always thought politicians are. They're supposed to be representatives of the people. And I thought that if I had the backing of people, then surely I could just continue to throw myself into it and try and do my best. Because what I've found about being a politician is it's actually much like becoming an adult. So, you know, when you're a kid, you think adults, like, have a clue. You don't ever know the meaning of life and those kinds of things. But unfortunate news for you. When you become an adult, you realise nobody knows what the hell is going on. And becoming a politician is much like that. You just realise that everybody's just doing the best that they can with the resources available to them. So, yeah, it's actually been really, really cool and really privileging to be in this role. And for that, for the reason as to why I've come to this place, I don't think I can ever turn my back on the people who brought me here.
If you could have one ministry, what would it be?
At the moment, like talking about 2017, it would be the Ministry for Youth Affairs. And that is just acknowledging the fact that I'm a first-term MP, and any first-term MP taking on a ministry is a massive challenge. But at the same time, I think I'm, you know, the technical term for me inside the 52nd Parliament is the baby of the House. That's what the youngest person in the House is called. So I think that in that respect, I'm one of only two people under the age of 30. The other guy's 29. So I think I'm the only person who can genuinely say that I am young and I speak for young people. But that's also acknowledging the fact that I don't think that all young people are homogenous. What I mean by that is not all young people are the same. Different young people obviously vote different ways. Different young people care about different things, want to go into different careers, all of those kinds of things. But I have grown up in a time where I have seen similar challenges to other young people. And I also think it's the pointy end of a lot of the issues that we see in society at the moment, whether it's mental health or lack of job prospects or the likes of the housing market at the moment. Those are all problems that manifest really disproportionately affect young people.
Providing a voice for young people, is that your biggest goal for your time here in Parliament?
I'm still working on what my goals are in my time here in Parliament. As we've kind of already gone over, I never intended to be a politician. I kind of fell into it. So I haven't got this big, massive career plan laid out. For the time being, I want to ensure that I can show all people that if I can do it, they can do it too. And politics belongs to all of us. Because there's the thing which really makes me the most distressed looking at voter turnout statistics is that the people who have the most to gain by voting are the least likely to vote. So those are our poorest, people who don't come from privilege, people who don't own homes, those kinds of people. And that's because they've given up faith in the political system. And I don't blame them, because the behaviour of politicians over the past few decades and economic reform after social reform has really encouraged us to look after ourselves. And that's resulted in this kind of mantra of personal responsibility. But I don't think that personal responsibility, you know, yeah, whatever, it's important, but it can't solve the biggest issues of our time. Those issues look like climate change, which again, disproportionately affect younger people. They look like the refugee crisis, wars raging, you know, seemingly eternally in these far-flung lands. All of those kinds of things which we have to come together to solve.
What's your dream?
My dream would be a functioning democracy. Yeah, and I think that the most functional democracy looks like high voter turnout. But beyond that, I also think that there's a lot to be said for not just voter turnout, but people, you know, petitioning and getting involved in collective action, like protests when you're uncomfortable the way things are, obviously peaceful protests, and submitting to select committees. And just realising their power, my dream would be rebuilding communities. And when I say that, I'm not, like, suggesting that we, like, hark back to the 1950s, because that had its own problems, you know, with conservatism and particularly the way that, you know, people who were gay were treated, or people who were of different coloured skin were treated, all those kinds of things. So what I'd like to see is us moving into a progressive time where everybody is respected, everybody is valued, but everybody has the basics. And the basics to me look like a decent job and a decent home, and you can live a life that is livable and meaningful. I'd also, I'm a big constitution nerd, so another thing I would like to play a part in, if I can only play a tiny part, would be helping to introduce a codified Supreme Constitution for this country.
So you want a written constitution?
Well, we kind of do have a written constitution at the moment. It's just founded in a lot of different documents, but there are obviously some unwritten parts as well. But then there's like the religious patent and some, like, the Bill of Rights Act, Section 4, which says that if there's any piece of legislation which is inconsistent with our Bill of Rights, the inconsistent legislation trumps our Bill of Rights, which is bizarre, to say the least. So, yeah, I do think that we need a written constitution in colloquial terms.
So, as one of the most successful young people around...
I'll take that, thank you.
How many 23-year-olds are in office at the moment?
Well, that's true, but... At the same time, I don't think that this is necessarily a gauge of success, but thank you.
What advice just generally would you have for today's youth?
I'm kind of always loath to give people advice because it sounds like I'm sitting in like an ivory tower and just like dishing down like my advice, like I've made it to the peak. I don't think I have made it to the peak. I've still got a lot to figure out myself. I'm very conscious of the fact that I've got a very steep learning curve in this place. And in that respect, I've accepted the fact that I'm going to fail sometimes. So I guess if I can give any form of advice, it would just be know that failure is inevitable at some point, but that shouldn't stop you. You can learn from your failures. I've failed lots in my life so far, but the reason that I've been able to continue going is just because I know that that's part of the process. I'm so like over the cliches of shouldn't be afraid to succeed or whatever, you know, the classics, but... It's basically along those lines. I'd also just say one thing that young people have the power to kind of break is this really pervasive way that we in New Zealand kind of talk badly about our friends and don't like other people succeeding. I think that we should all be supporting each other. So I think that that's something which doesn't necessarily relate to the success of an individual, but relates to breeding a community of people. That sounds awful, brilliant, but people who... all do the best for themselves and the communities, so look out for each other, basically.
Next year, the Greens are going to have a female leadership election.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you would think about standing for?
It's not something I'm personally interested in. I think I've got a lot of other stuff on my plate at the moment, including getting a first term in Parliament under my belt.
Just going to move on to some conscious issues.
Yep.
Abortion, do you support decriminalisation and further legalisation?
It is a very heated, very deeply personal subject, and I think that that conversation should be led by people with personal experience.
Cannabis decriminalisation and legalisation?
Legalisation. That's Green Party policy. The reason that we move for legalisation as opposed to decriminalisation is decriminalisation will still keep weed in the hands of gangs. Legalisation will look like a fully regulated market, which will also generate tax revenue, which will then be invested back into mental health services, drug and addiction and abuse services as well. So we just recognise that it is working and it has proven to work in other places around the world, and we want to follow best practice. Also, prohibition hasn't worked. 400,000 New Zealanders per year self-report to smoking marijuana, and it's just a fact of the matter where if you look at the way the criminal justice system behaves now towards marijuana, it is the case where we kind of already have ad hoc decriminalisation. So police on the front lines aren't necessarily arresting people for it anymore, which I find really problematic because that puts discretion in the power of the police, which means that the average person doesn't necessarily know what the law is, if you know what I mean. Yeah. If the law isn't being enforced as it's written, that's a problem, so we need to change the law.
Retention of the multi sets.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that... that's a contentious thing. This is the problem of me being a politician. I also think that we could potentially relook at the way that Parliament itself is structured. We could have more of a two-party-based parliamentary structure, but I think that the result of whatever that looks like could come out of constitutional consultation process.
What do you think we should do with some number of MPs in your parliamentary restructure? Do you think we should raise it, lower it, or...?
Are you talking about the number of MPs?
Yes.
I think that first and foremost, before we talk about increasing or decreasing the number of MPs, we have to increase the understanding that the average citizen has about what MPs actually do. We should also probably increase the understanding of how MMP works. So it's really fascinating. MMP was introduced about 21 years ago. And if you look at research, more New Zealanders understood it 21 years ago than they do now. And that's because there was public service announcement ads and education campaigns run at that time. But nowadays, people are just kind of, you just go to the polling booth and the media is the one who's supposed to inform you of how MMP works, or our education system, where we don't have a stringently enforced civics education system. But to get back to the root of your question, I don't think that the constitutional reform or changing the number of seats or anything like that is something that any individual group or party can dictate. I think that that has to be done in full, wide consultation with the people of this country.
So you're suggesting referendum?
Not for a constitution. I think that it has to be much broader than a referendum.
No, I mean a referendum on the number of MPs.
No, I don't think there should be a referendum on the number of MPs.
Foreign deployment of New Zealand troops overseas, like in Afghanistan and Iraq?
I think that the Green Party's charter is founded on four major principles. One of them is non-violence. So we believe in peace, basically, and we think that there are better ways to resolve many of the conflicts that we as predominantly Western countries have gone into, where we have played a part in the loss of lives of innocent people.
Right. New Zealand becoming a republic?
Again, that would be part of constitutional reform, but my personal opinion is yes.
Assisted dying, is that something you'd vote for?
I need to get familiar with David Seymour's bill. I do support, in principle, the notion of assisted dying where somebody is terminally ill and in chronic pain. But I think that we need to have serious safeguards. One thing that we, the Greens have flagged, and it's particularly evident in David's bill, I've got a copy of it over there, so I'm looking over there, is that it doesn't have the amount of safeguards in place that would stop, for example, pressure mounting on disabled persons if their family were able to convince them of, you know, plant some really nasty ideas in their mind. So I think that we need the right safeguards, but in principle.
Moving on to a more lighthearted question. You're trapped on a desert island with an MP from an opposing party. Who would you choose? And before you answer, I should let you know that both Kerry Allen and Jenny Anderson both chose you.
Yeah, I totally chose Kerry. I was going to say, does that count as an opposing party? We've got the email. Well, actually, the email you expired on election day. But, yeah, Kitty and I are real good friends, so I'd totally choose Kitty. I'd also trust her to, like, hunt and stuff. She's on the East Coast. We'd have good conversations. It'd be great.
Yeah. All right. Finally, is there anything else you want to say that I haven't covered?
No, what's this podcast called? Meet the Newbies?
Yeah.
I think it's really cool that you're doing this and that you're trying to shed a light on, I guess, to a certain extent, the psyche of the people who have been elected to the big house, who've been making rules for, the rest of New Zealand. So I applaud your money.
Thank you. All right, this has been Chloe Spardick. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.